This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to Trumpet Hour this Friday, June 28th, 2024, the week of more rumblings of strategy and war from the Middle East, of another consequential decision by the Supreme Court, and of a consequential presidential debate. We'll talk about these developments and more with our four staff writers from the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and thetrumpet.com, Andrew Miller, who covers Anglo-America.
Hello.
Jeremiah Jacques, who covers Asia.
Thanks for having me.
Those two are here in studio with me. Over there in Edstone, England, is Mihailo Zekic, who covers the Middle East.
Hello.
And Richard Palmer, who covers Europe.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Palmer, of course, serving as the assistant managing editor of thetrumpet.com, the author of The Morning Brief as well, and was your Once and Future Friday host last week. And in weeks to come, we'll let you know more about that in the future, but back to the present major developments this week, and we'll treat them in that order, starting with Anglo-America. Andrew Miller, we were preparing this outline this morning and just throwing one thing after another at you that the Anglo-America region needs to be covered.
Yeah, it was definitely a big week in the Anglo-America region. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau suffered a pretty shocking defeat in local Toronto elections. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange agreed to plead guilty to a felony in exchange for release from prison. So he's going to be out of prison for the first time in many years. The heads of state for the world's two oldest monarchies met this week when King Charles III of England welcomed Emperor Naruhito of Japan to London. And here in our very own Oklahoma, a directive sent by Republican State Superintendent Ryan Waters is instructing all public schools to teach both the Bible and the Ten Commandments as cornerstones of Western civilization.
We're going to make an important announcement today regarding the Bible and the Ten Commandments. My staff has been looking at Oklahoma statute. We've been looking at Oklahoma academic standards, and it's crystal clear to us that in the Oklahoma academic standards, under Title 70, multiple occasions, the Bible is a necessary historical document to teach our kids about the history of this country, to have a complete understanding of Western civilization, to have an understanding of the basis of our legal system, and it's frankly, we're talking about the Bible, one of the most foundational documents used for the Constitution and the birth of our country. We also find major points in history that refer to the Bible, that reference the Bible. We see multiple figures, whether we're talking about the Federalist Papers, constitutional conventional arguments, and Martin Luther King Jr., who use it as a tremendous impetus for the civil rights movement and tie many of those arguments back to the Bible. It is essential that our kids have an understanding of the Bible and its historical context. So we will be issuing a memo today that every school district will adhere to, which is that every teacher, every classroom in the state will have a Bible in the classroom and will be teaching from the Bible in the classroom to ensure that this historical understanding is there for every student in the state of Oklahoma in accordance with our academic standards and state law.
So that's a clip there again from Ryan Walters, the state superintendent of schools here in Oklahoma. It's something to see Oklahoma in the headlines trending on X or on Citizen Free Press. But that's a really strong statement in the culture wars. And you see some of the conservatives fighting back.
Yeah, it is definitely nice to have a piece of good news to include in the Anglo Watch, as most of these stories are either bad news or exasperating. Our next story I'm going to talk about, which isn't my main story actually this week, is one of the more exasperating stories, is that last night we had the first presidential debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, aired at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. People across the nation watched it, and as far as the content of it, it's probably what you'd have expected with you've got your Democrat talking points and your Republican talking points. But one of the things with this particular debate has people talking this morning is just how senile or incoherent Biden seemed. This is actually a write-up from Politico, which is a pretty left-leaning paper. It says, he stammered, he stumbled, and with fewer than 5 months to November, he played straight into Democrats' worst fears that he's fumbling away this election to Donald Trump. Minutes into the debate, he just struggled to mount an effective defense of the economy on his watch. He flubbed the description of key health initiatives that's made central to his reelection bid. And then when he wasn't talking, like I said, when he wasn't stumbling or flubbing, or he just stood there like, he'd almost, it's too bad he can't show a picture on radio, because he just stood frozen with his mouth agape and his eyes wide, just looking something towards. It's definitely came across as the look of a man who's not mentally coherent. And I guess if you've been watching the videos on Twitter, Republicans have been saying that for about 3 years now. But now you're even getting Main Street journalists, even Politico journalists, saying that, like, Trump definitely, it's like, they're leftists, so they don't agree with what Trump said, but he said he definitely won the debate on style. And some are even talking about that with, like, 5 months to November, they may need to replace the Democratic candidate.
Right. This is a candidate who is in the White House. He's the incumbent. He's the presumed nominee. And at this late stage, they're talking about replacing him. It just underlines, I think, the tumult in American politics. A lot of, even as you say, Democrats mentioning the dazed look, the dilated pupils of his eyes, apparently, the fact that he refused to agree to a drug test challenged by Donald Trump prior to the debate, and the fact that he was away from the White House at Camp David in the woods preparing for the debate. Some people were saying, well, who's running the country while he's, you know, getting his debate practice in? So all of these things underline, I think, just the troubling nature of the Biden presidency. We were talking a little bit earlier about, is this just the fact that we're Americans and we're interested in the American debate? We're wondering, Richard Palmer, what the international interest in the debate is and reaction to it.
German politicians suggest Biden withdraw. That's a headline from Spiegel, Germany's news. I don't know whether there's any Americans sitting on the edge of their seat wondering what German politicians are advising them to do. But it is instructive to see the heads of German political parties freaking out over this. These are names that I recognize. I think people like Norbert Röttingen, who's a very senior member of the, I believe he's the Christian Democratic Union. He's their foreign policy spokesman, been around for a long, long time. He said, this night will not be forgotten. The Democrats have to change their seats now. Free Democratic Party said that we're heading for a historic tragedy in November. They really don't want Donald Trump to win. She said the Democrats must react immediately and send a new candidate into the race. The government's official transatlantic representative, Michael Link, he said Joe Biden presented many facts unclearly and was sometimes difficult to understand linguistically. So perhaps a bit understated, but he also suggested that they pick another candidate. So this is a country heavily invested in Donald Trump losing in November. He is very unpopular there. And they saw this debate as a catastrophe. I think for a lot of people overseas, they've been living in the CNN bubble. You know, for the last 2 weeks, we've seen Joe Biden wander around and stuff. Well, we've seen it a lot longer than that. But for the last 2 weeks, CNN and et cetera has been kind of telling us, no, he's perfectly healthy. He's fine. Who are you going to believe, us or your lying eyes? There's no issues here. And that's the bubble that I think a lot of people outside the United States have been living in. And then they wake up this morning and watch the highlight reel. You know, this was going at, say, 2 a.m. And I doubt a lot in Europe are going to sit down and watch all 90 minutes. But the bits that you do see are just dip, 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 dip for doing what I'm doing
right.
for like a full minute or two. And I think that's a lot of scales falling from people's eyes, realizing, okay, those that have been talking to us about Joe Biden being cognitively impaired, well, they've been lying.
That's
you
right.
You'd hope that it would cause them to start saying, well, maybe we've been lied to about other things as well, and perhaps reevaluate their entire view of the U.S. political spectrum. But certainly they're starting to realize, well, Joe Biden is not the shoe-in that we thought, and we could well have Donald Trump back in the White House in November.
Going back to what you mentioned about who are you going to believe, the infallible us or your lying eyes, Ben Rhodes, the former Obama-era official, he tweeted this in response to the debate. He said, quote, telling people they didn't see what they saw is not the way to respond to this, end quote. That's a pretty candid admission from somebody that used to be in the same government with Joe Biden when he was vice president. And like what you were talking about earlier, Philip, about how even Democrats are saying that, you know, we can't do this anymore. Claire McCaskill, former Democratic senator, she told MSNBC, quote, Joe Biden had one thing he had to do tonight and he didn't do it. He had one thing he had to accomplish, and that was to reassure America he was up to the job at his age, and he failed at that tonight, end quote. It's almost, in a sense, like an emperor's new clothes kind of scenario, where this whole time the elite have been telling us, no, no, the emperor has clothes on, they're just so brilliant you can't see them with your eyes. And then finally, things are just so obvious, saying, you know what, the jig is up. You could think of that as like maybe an admission that, okay, this is too stupid, even we can't hide this. But they knew that this debate probably was going to be bad going into it. You have to wonder what kind of 3D chess is going on behind the scenes, say perhaps to sneak in another candidate that they wanted the whole time but didn't think they could win the election. I've heard that this is, to have a debate this early before the nominations have even officially happened is pretty unusual. And to have the next debate happening in September with months until Biden can have a bit of a comeback attempt, if you will, perhaps this is, again, some 3D chess going on to try and set him up so they can get somebody they'd like in. We don't know. We'll find out. But there is certainly something fishy going on there.
So as you say, Mihailo Zekic and Richard Palmer, this glimpse at Joe Biden's physical and mental state comes even after the liberal media has been spinning Donald Trump as having mental problems, mental weakness, trying to get the focus off of Joe Biden's mental state. And after CNN basically locked down the debate, they wouldn't even let the White House Correspondents Association have a single reporter in there during the debate, the last I saw. So this was a lockdown debate. And even still, the glimpse at Joe Biden that we saw from it is of a weak man mentally and physically. And as you say, Richard Palmer, the Germans are watching, the Europeans are watching the American presidency, even the presidential debates 5 months ahead of the election, being watched, not so much because of Joe Biden, but because of Donald Trump. They're definitely on one side of this debate, many of them, of this election. So definitely something to continue to watch, the American presidency in tumult. But Andrew Miller, that's not even the main story. What's the main story in Anglo-America?
Well, the main story connects to it somewhat. But what I really want to talk about this week is the Supreme Court has basically given the federal government permission to keep instructing social media companies to censor information they do not want you to see, hear, or read. It's probably good news for Biden. I think the last opinion poll I checked on it said that something like 1 in 5 Biden voters said they probably wouldn't have voted for Biden if they would have known about the Hunter Biden laptop before the last election. But they didn't know about that laptop because the FBI instructed, and the Biden administration together, instructed Twitter and other social media companies to take that information down. They also instructed them to take down a bunch of information about COVID vaccines and the lab leak theory that they didn't like. And basically what had happened after they did that is the state of Missouri sued the federal government, coming in and saying that, like, we know that private companies can say what they want, but the First Amendment guarantees free speech, and the federal government cannot instruct these private companies to determining what they can and cannot say or removing this information. So it went all the way up to the Supreme Court and had, in my opinion, a pretty horrendous decision here where Justice Amy Coney Barrett and 5 other justices, Amy Coney Barrett wrote the majority opinion, and then it was signed by 5 other justices, ruled that, well, the state of Missouri doesn't really have standing in this case because they weren't censoring their words explicitly. They weren't the ones specifically wronged. And that since Twitter and these companies were liberal anyway, they were already censoring that type of information. So the federal government directive probably didn't change the direction of the company, of the censorship content. Justice Samuel Alito wrote the dissenting opinion along with Neil Gorsuch and Justice Thomas, which is really powerful. I've actually got a copy of it in front of me, where this is Justice Alito saying that this is, quote, one of the most important free speech cases to reach this court in years. So he's saying, so this isn't a minor case that should just be like, well, you don't have standing, so let's dismiss this. He admits in the dissenting opinion, he's like, yes, the First Amendment guarantees free speech. It doesn't apply to private companies, but the government, the federal government, can't instruct private companies what speech is allowed. Because in his words, he said, of course, purely private entities like newspapers are not subject to the First Amendment, and as a result, they may publish or decline to publish whatever they wish. But government officials may not coerce private entities into suppressing free speech. And then he goes on later to say, the court shirks the duty and thus permits the successful campaigning of coercion in this case to stand as an attractive model for future officials who want to control what people say, hear, and think. That is regrettable. So basically making the point that the Wall Street Journal also made this week, that the Biden administration and the FBI, they're going to take this court case as permission to keep doing what they were doing last election. Keep censoring their rights. It's like the Supreme Court's come in and says, like, okay, well, they didn't have standing. Even that, when you think about it, is like, yes, the state of Missouri didn't have their tweets censored. But as one of the 50 states in a nation that allegedly elected a president who they may not have elected if they would have known about the Hunter Biden laptop and some of these other scandals, you could say there's like, well, really every American has some standing in this case. If you look at it, they're like, Biden may not even be president, probably wouldn't be president, if it weren't for the fact that all the stories about his son's corruptions and other things were censored from public discourse on the FBI's directive. I mean, if you keep up with the Twitter files even explain it like a master canine relationship, where the FBI is the master and Twitter's the canine. And just like a police dog will move, or a sheepdog will move by hand signals, you're controlling it that much. And so they've thrown this out on this standing technicality. But the dissent, which if you're really interested in free speech, is worth a read, saying that this is actually one of the most important free speech cases, if not the most important free speech case, to have reached the Supreme Court. The court had a duty to uphold the First Amendment. And at least in Justice Alito's opinion, completely shirked that duty by really not even addressing the substance of the case, by just saying, right, they're like, well, Missouri wasn't specifically wronged more than anyone else, so we're not even really going to look at this.
Right. Basically dismissing it on the Supreme Court equivalent of a technicality. And I think you just make a really good point there that the court can make decisions and should make decisions based on the First Amendment itself and the actual real effect of these relationships between the government and private companies on free speech.
I think these are all really great points. And I think one very concerning thing that someone pointed out to me is the Supreme Court twisting its rulings because of their political effect. As in, are there judges on the court and some of these conservative judges that are kind of looking at public opinion and thinking people are painting us as a conservative court to appear balanced? We need to give the liberals some wins. And honestly, the logic in Amy Coney Barrett's ruling, I find so twisted and torturous. She's written some very incisive, clever, erudite things before. And I just find it very hard seeing this as coming from the same mind. It just, you know, she's arguing, well, it doesn't really matter because they're probably not going to do it again. And social media was censoring before the government got involved. So therefore, somehow it's like, there seem big logical flaws in her reasoning. But that, I think, is even more worrying. If the court is twisting the rules, twisting and not judging by rule of law, but instead keeping an eye on the polls and judging by what they think the public want, you know, that's dangerous. You're eroding the rule of law to try and uphold a certain reputation.
That's right. And that's why the court sometimes makes decisions where you say, I thought you were a conservative, but they make a decision that allow the liberals more power or whatever. They are saying no matter what our political views are, this underlying constitutional principle is, you know, X, Y, or Z. And so that's why watching the court can be kind of confusing. But as you say, in this particular case, Mr. Palmer, the actual official reasoning of the majority opinion written by a constitutionally conservative notionally justice is noticeably unconstitutional, is noticeably bad. I mean, the point that, well, they did it during COVID and COVID is probably not going to happen again, to kind of dumb down her terms, but that was her reasoning, is on its face not the case, because the government, when it gets a power, it's going to use it. You know, whether the emergency, quote unquote, is COVID or whether the emergency is something else, all the justices know that. Many people watching the court know that. So the court making this decision is major news. It is a reason to continue to watch this court, to watch its involvement. There's a bunch of decisions still to come out in this term. I believe they even extended the term by a month, if I'm remembering that right. So a lot more to come from the court.
No, it is just a really significant story to keep watching on. Well, as we often do on the show, we'll put America under attack by our editor-in-chief in the show notes. But the basic premise of that book is about a prophecy in Daniel 8 about truth being cast to the ground by an organized host led by an Antiochus figure. And of course, if you've watched the show for any period of time, you'll know that the Antiochus figure is Barack Obama. And he's leading this organized host to cast truth to the ground. But I think the Twitter files and the social media case has really kind of exposed the nuts and bolts and inner workings of this organized host like few things ever have. You can even get like out diagrams about which government agency is working through which non-governmental organization or academic institution or nonprofit organization to instruct like Twitter, Google, and many, many other companies what they can and can't say. And so, like Justice Alito phrases it, officials want to control what people say, hear, and think. And so if you're going to cast like the truth to the ground, like the truth about the Hunter Biden laptop, that is a truth that Americans had a right to know about before the election that was hidden, cast to the ground, if you will, because you've got not just a few liberal censors at Twitter who are censoring what things they don't personally like, but there's actually like well ingrained communication channels flowing from Barack Obama through the FBI and the State Department into a whole constellation of non-governmental organizations and then into Silicon Valley. Some of these channels even crossing the Atlantic into Europe, controlling what they can see, hear, and think. And so it is definitely that word in Daniel 8, host, it says that Antiochus was given a host to cast truth to the ground. I mean, if you look it up in any Bible concordance, it means like an organized host or an army. It's not just a mob or a rabble. And so you definitely see this in casting truth to the ground, that they have a very organized governmental network designed to censor stuff like this. Justice Alito was saying that the Supreme Court really had a responsibility to expose this, but unfortunately, there were six other justices who disagreed with him.
That's right. We need to continue to watch what all nine of the justices are doing, the decisions yet to come. The reasoning behind the decisions, as Mr. Palmer pointed out there, and the importance of the court, and especially the presidency, is underlined in America Under Attack, which you mentioned. And also, I'll mention the latest issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet. This is the August issue. It's the one with Benjamin Netanyahu on the cover, and we'll get to the Middle East in a moment. But this issue talks about the law. We've got injustice and lawlessness, a prophet's warning, the failure and ultimate victory of international law. We need one standard of justice and also uphold the law in your home. So several articles there about the importance of law. And just as you look at news from the court, as you look at this magazine, but as you look at the news around, you realize how much of it does revolve around law, how much of it does revolve around truth, but even just law, which is often not the exact same thing as truth, but this very concept of the rule of law. Americans and people everywhere need to at least start by recognizing the importance of your relationship, of your society's relationship with law. We've taken too long. We've taken it for granted for at least a generation, at least my generation, that the rule of law is there, that the laws are decent. And now you're seeing it, as you said, through a well-developed channels being actively dismantled. And the consequences for that are just impossible to describe. But again, subscribe to The Trumpet. Go to thetrumpet.com. Check out the August edition and subscribe for yourself. And also order your free copy of America Under Attack. And also for more on the Supreme Court and especially the American presidency, go to thetrumpet.com and watch The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Fleury. I'm sure today's show and shows to come will cover what's been happening with the debates and with the court. And also sign up for The Trumpet Brief, maybe one of the best things you can do. Make your inbox relevant again. That's at thetrumpet.com/brief. I said we'd get to the Middle East, but first we'll cover the region of Asia. Jeremiah Jacques, you've been watching Asia. Can you give us a rundown of the top stories this week?
Yes. First, a story here about China's involvement in America's fentanyl crisis. This was in the Washington Times on Tuesday, and it details the way the Chinese are laundering drug money for Mexican cartels so that those cartels can keep on pushing fentanyl onto Americans, keep on fueling the crisis and just destabilizing the country. So we have talked on the show before about how many people understand that China is making the precursor chemicals that cartels use to make this deadly fentanyl. But what most people don't realize is that that's only the start of China's involvement in this scourge. The Chinese are also helping the Mexicans press the fentanyl into pill form. They help them smuggle those pills into the U.S. They help them communicate with each other on encrypted Chinese phones. And as this new report confirms, after that's all, you know, over and done with, the Chinese then help the Mexicans launder their money so that they can just keep on expanding their drug empires, keep on killing as many Americans as possible. So it is incredibly wicked what the Chinese are doing here. And this is just one more of a long list of developments showing that America needs to wake up to the threat from China. Another story here about Russia kidnapping children from Ukraine's war-torn regions. The count now is believed to be around 20,000. 20,000 children that have been stolen and relocated, put into various kinds of foster care in most cases, where they face a whole range of abuses. But there was some good news this week, with Ukraine reporting that they've managed to bring back around 800 of the children that had been abducted. So that's encouraging to hear about those 800, but it leaves thousands and thousands still unaccounted for. And of course, the end of the war is nowhere in sight at this point. So this is an ongoing tragedy that's happening with these kidnapped children. And then one final quick story here about a new report showing that America's drinking water is facing a range of cyber attacks from Chinese, Russian, and Iranian hackers. This report is from the Environmental Protection Agency, and it shows that foreign-linked cyber criminals are increasingly focused on taking out America's critical national infrastructure, and they know that if America suddenly didn't have access to water, it could cause serious societal breakdown very quickly. This report says that at present, some 70% of drinking water systems are vulnerable and at risk. So this is potentially very serious.
Well, each of those rundown stories, if certain news executives would say this needs to lead our cable news broadcast, our main show of the evening, it could and should. I mean, the Chinese involvement in the drugging and overdosing of Americans, you have written on well, you have covered well on this show. And it remains to most people, I think, this vague kind of side issue, this kind of, oh, yeah, that's really bad. When you can see videos of the streets of major American cities of people walking around like zombies, and yet that's not a major story. It's not the same as the Holocaust. But if news executives said, oh, we don't want to cover the Holocaust, you know, after the war, then we wouldn't know about it. We wouldn't think about it. We wouldn't think it's a big deal. So I've said this before. I'm going to say it just a couple more times to you, dear listener. But you need to be the one to decide what's important for yourself. If you rely too heavily on the cable news executives' decisions on what the narrative is going to be and what's important, then you're going to be deceived, especially in this time of truth being cast to the ground, as you said, Andrew Miller. But these are major stories. These are major problems. This is historic injustice and wrong that is happening to these Ukrainian children, to Americans who are captured in drug usage. And I just need to actively think and understand the importance of what is happening in this country and around the world and in Asia. So what's the main story that you wanted to bring us from Asia?
It is that North Korea plans to send military engineer units to Ukraine as early as next month to assist Russia's war effort. So this is according to a Reuters report from Monday, which cited South Korea's TV Chosun. And the unit of engineers may arrive in Russian-occupied parts of Ukraine in just a few weeks. And the plan calls for these engineers to basically prepare the way for potentially significant numbers of North Korean troops to then come in and begin fighting alongside Russian forces. This report is not yet officially confirmed, but we know that North Korea has been supplying millions of artillery shells to Russia and also untold numbers of ballistic missiles. We also know that last week, Russian President Vladimir Putin traveled to North Korea. He signed a landmark security pact with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. And that security pact obligates both nations to come to each other's assistance if either is attacked. So this would not be at all out of the blue if North Korea does end up sending these engineers and then troops to fight alongside Russian soldiers. It would fit into a pattern in this increasingly close partnership that Russia and North Korea are building. And this is it's interesting in part because Putin has been dealing with manpower shortages lately. We heard Russian General Andrei Gurulov acknowledge that publicly a few weeks back. And North Korea is well positioned to help with this because they have mandatory conscription for men and women alike. And if you count reservists, paramilitary, and active troops, North Korea actually has the world's largest military force, 7.7 million personnel that they have altogether. So, you know, quality of troops, that's a different question. But in sheer numbers, North Korea is well positioned to help Russia mitigate its manpower struggles. And it appears very eager to do so in the spirit of building a stronger bond with Russia. And of course, they'll also be able to get new weapons technologies from the Russians as well.
You're looking at North Korea could send easily a tenth of their active personnel force just to accrue some experience and get combat time. And it would be a game-changing source of personnel to them.
That was military analyst Paul Lewandowski there, and he makes a good point that this would also be valuable to the North Koreans just to give their forces some battlefield experience that they don't currently have. And then he also argues compellingly, I think, there that for Russia, this is potentially at least a game changer. So there's still a great deal that we don't know, but this is certainly a story to keep on carefully watching.
So as we say, we could spend much more time on the active Chinese Communist Party drugging, overdosing of Americans, empowering drug thugs and cartels. We could spend much more time on the mass kidnapping of Ukrainian children. Think about that. Mass kidnapping of children is happening in your world. Happened last week, is happening this week. But you direct our attention to North Korean military engineers traveling to Russia and Ukraine. There's got to be a reason for that. What's the reason that this is worth dwelling on?
Yeah, well, it's because this story takes on quite a lot of importance in light of some specific Bible prophecies. First of all, there's Ezekiel 38, verse 2, and this describes an individual called the Prince of Rosh. That's how it's translated in the New King James. And Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has said that word Rosh could be rendered as Russia. So this should say the Prince of Russia. And he has said that Vladimir Putin is this prince. And then if you read through Ezekiel 38 and 39, you see that this prince will soon be leading a massive army into World War III. And there's another passage in Revelation 9 that tells us exactly how massive that force will be. That's verse 16, and it says it'll have 200 million troops. So just a stunning size. But if you look at Russia, they've got a total population just over 140 million. So, you know, Russia on its own could never field an army of 200 million troops. But Ezekiel 38 lists several ancient names that designate certain modern Asian nations that will subordinate themselves to Russia and make their armies a part of that 200 million man force. You can see names there signifying modern China and India as well. And then you come to verse 6. And with this week's news in mind, this is very interesting because verse 6 says a people called Gomer will also lend their soldiers to this army that Vladimir Putin will lead. And Gomer, as we've explained on thetrumpet.com, is the primary ancestor of modern Korea. So these passages are saying Korean soldiers will be a part of the gargantuan multinational Asian force that Putin will soon be leading. And right now we see North Korea is subordinating themselves to Putin's Russia, supplying vast amounts of weaponry, even planning to send men to assist the war effort. So really, I think we're seeing the groundwork being laid for North Korea to take its place in the Putin-led 200 million man army.
We'll put two links into the show notes: North Korea to send military unit to Ukraine in coming weeks to help Russia, and The Prophesied Prince of Russia, that booklet by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. We were just talking about how you, dear listener, need to decide what's major news, what's important, not let cable news executives decide for you, or politicians, or the FBI working through censorship through social media, or Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. You need to be the one to decide what's major news, what you need to know more about, and what's a distraction, effectively. But can you do that yourself? Can I do that myself? It's just not logical to say that any one of us has the right way to divine, to decide what's important and what isn't. Trumpet Hour asserts that the Bible, and the Bible prophecy specifically, is the way that you decide what is important and what isn't. And so that's why we would bring you this development, bringing North Korea closer to Russia, when some of these other topics are more emotional, are still prophetically relevant, but to look into the Bible, look into prophecy, and let that determine for you what is important news and what isn't. And so that's why we bring you this development on North Korea's increased cooperation with Russia and what that is leading to. Watch the news, see if that's what eventuates from this. And then you've got a decision to make about, is Bible prophecy true? And then what else does that mean about the Bible? What else about the Bible is true? And do you need to act upon? That is Anglo-America and Asia. We'll be right back with Europe and the Middle East.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Welcome back to Trumpet Hour. As mentioned, we have covered the news this week in Anglo-America, including a bit of a glimpse into Europe's reaction, particularly to the presidential debate, and specifically to the phenomenon of a return of Donald Trump to the presidency. And we've covered the news in Asia, more awareness of the Chinese Communist Party drugging, poisoning America, Russians mass kidnapping children, and why North Korea military engineers aiding Russia in Ukraine is a bigger story than you might think. Now we move to Europe and the Middle East. But before that, Mr. Palmer, during the break, you were informing us that the Supreme Court is issuing more rulings as we speak. The Fisher case, the disruption of an official proceeding case where the Department of Justice used a law passed after the Enron scandal to charge hundreds of January 6th protesters. The Supreme Court has ruled that that does not apply. And so that's a major decision coming out of the Supreme Court again as we speak, as well as the Chevron standard, a ruling that effectively takes some power back from the bureaucracy, back from what's the executive branch, but these agencies that basically have executive, judicial, and somewhat legislative power all combined into one, which was not the intention of the Constitution. It seems like this Chevron standard ruling now takes some of that power back from this enormous bureaucratic state and returns more of it to the constitutional offices of Congress, the courts, and the presidency. So continue to watch SCOTUS, but Mr. Palmer, I'll pitch it to you to introduce news from Europe.
The European Council has announced their picks for top EU jobs. I won't go through all the different bureaucrats that you'll have never heard of. And there's a very good chance that this won't make it through the European Parliament that gets to say yes or no on a lot of these different officials. But you're having this kind of horse trading going on for who's going to have what job at the top of the European Union. The most significant takeaway from it is probably the strategy that's been pursued. The European Parliament is very divided after the election, and you've had the rise of the fringe, the rise of the far right, as the mainstream media would call it. How do they deal with that? And the jockeying for position over these jobs has shown that. And a lot of people said, well, the smart thing to do is to bring in, say, some people like Giorgia Meloni, bring them into the fold, divide and rule, play divide and rule with the far right, and embrace the less radical elements so you exclude the more radical elements. They didn't do that. Giorgia Meloni voted against several of these appointments. She abstained on the crucial one for the European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen. They've now got to get her through Parliament without Meloni's support then, presumably. So the fact, though, that they're doing this shows they're not trying to play that divide and rule strategy. This could be very interesting going forward, where they're deliberately trying to exclude this rising faction within Europe, and you could see then that rising faction pushing for more radical change within the European Union, something that we, of course, know is coming. Also here in the UK, we've got our election scandal. That's what I'm getting to. An election scandal underway here in the UK. So we've got elections. In the UK, the way elections work, we don't have a date set 4 years in advance the way that it is in the United States. Instead, there's a maximum date, a kind of a best before end of, an expiry date for the government. But within that five-year period, they can call an election anytime they want. And you can go and place bets, if you like, on when you think the government will hold an election. That's not permission. I'm not saying I'm not giving permission to go and place bets, but people can do that. And the scandal is that as soon as the government kind of decided on a July election and before they announced it, a whole bunch of people in the know ran down to their local bookies and placed bets on there being a July election. It's insider trading, but perhaps technically not illegal because it's not stock invest. Like, people are looking into this and saying, well, surely they can be arrested. And I don't know, but a lot of the legal minds are saying, well, actually, no, there's no rule that says you can't do this. It's not the stock market. It's the betting shop. But it's people at the top of the Conservative Party doing this. It's a lot of police officers. They're kind of the equivalent of the Secret Service, those police that are guarding top politicians. So who would overhear these kind of conversations? There's seven of them so far that have been caught making these kind of bets. It's dragging the reputation of the Conservative Party and even the police through the mud. The kind of the first thought of we're going to have an election is not how can we win, but ooh, I could use this to make a quick buck, is got a lot of people pretty disappointed. The one aspect of this that did make me laugh is then a Labour politician has been caught where he placed bets on himself losing his election, which is terrible and almost seems secretly genius, though, because of course if it comes out, he then becomes unpopular and goes on to lose his election. So it's kind of a self-fulfilling bet. But that's where we are in Britain's politics. Our top politicians are more interested in trying to make a quick buck than on winning an election. Very different scandal in Germany, where Björn Höcke from this Alternative for Deutschland, this fringe right, far right party that we've been talking about rising in Germany, he is facing a second prosecution for using the slogan Everything for Germany, Alles für Deutschland, the banned slogan because it was the slogan for the Nazi stormtroopers. This is what the Nazis shouted while they dragged people out into the streets and beat them up. He was kind of inciting a crowd to chant this. And so he's allegedly, I should say this is all allegedly, he's standing trial for this. He's not been prosecuted yet. He has already been prosecuted for this in a separate case. He's been fined €30,000. That has apparently not put him off. And you're getting this fringe right party in Germany deliberately going out there using Nazi slogans. So I think that shows you where some of these political shenanigans are pushing Germany now into this far right direction. And then another story that really caught our attention this week was basically the Vatican's number two, the Secretary of State, jetting in to Lebanon. You know, Lebanon, this is one of the world's most important hotspots. You've got kind of the whole place on the brink of war. You've got Hezbollah carrying out these increasing attacks in exactly the way that we have talked about over the last few weeks. You had them threatening Cyprus. And now in comes the Catholic Church's top foreign policy expert. I mean, there's the potential here for a direct war between Israel and Iran. And you have this guy flying in there. And as far as we can tell, this was a fairly last-minute planned trip. He only announced it on June 19th before arriving on Sunday, I think it was, or Monday, right around then, which was June 23rd. It was circulating in Lebanon reports of this maybe a day or two earlier. But he's coming in there right at the last minute and visiting this key hotspot.
Yeah, this is not just a run-of-the-mill, last-minute goodwill trip. There's a lot more to the story of this. But before we get into that, there's a few other stories in the Middle East that I'd like to bring in. The Israeli Supreme Court released another ruling saying that the government has to conscript ultra-Orthodox yeshiva, religious school students, into the Israeli Defense Forces. We've talked about on this program before, there's tens of thousands of people that have had an unofficial exemption to this, and their demographic has since Israel hasn't founded it as a state. The Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. The Israeli government's been scrambling to find an opt-out. Prime Minister Netanyahu relies on a lot of ultra-Orthodox interest parties to stay in power. Looks like he hasn't found one. The Supreme Court has doubled down. Some of Netanyahu's coalition partners are threatening to bolt. This isn't necessarily tied up with some of the other attacks he's been getting, but it's another headache for him and one that, like some of these other problems he's had, could end the current Israeli government, but we'll have to wait and see what happens with that. Also today, Iran is having its first round of voting for the presidency since it was made vacant by Ebrahim Raisi's death. We've talked before about how ultimately Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is still in charge. He and his guardian council vet everybody that's going to run, so nobody's going to get in power that he doesn't like. And the one time that almost did happen, there was massive cheating and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad stayed in power way back when. But it is the Iranian president, it's not like he's a figurehead. He still is the main administrator of Khamenei's policies. So whoever comes in will definitely change the direction of the Middle East. The contestants belong to such interesting parties as the Combatant Clergy Association, and one guy that dropped out belonged to the Society of Path Seekers. So if you want an idea on the kind of religious views of some of these characters. But moving on to Paralin's visit. Officially, this was just to visit the local representatives of the Order of Malta. It's a Catholic chivalric order, a charity that does a lot of hospital work around the world. And Paralin was going to visit that. For that, again, he announced it last minute. He stayed 5 days, and he decided to interject quite a bit into Lebanese politics. He met with the prime minister of Lebanon there and two reporters. He spoke about for peace proposals to be welcomed with the current conflict in Gaza so that, quote, fighting stops on each side. He's not talking to the Israelis here. He's talking to the Lebanese people in Beirut. So you could just as easily interpret this as him like giving a nod to Hezbollah, saying, back down, we don't like this. Most concerning, or interesting, I should say, though, is his comments on the Lebanese presidency. Now, Lebanon has a figurehead president, like a lot of democratic republics do. Well, I guess in Lebanon's case, the flawed democracy. But it's supposed to be elected by the parliament, and parliament hasn't been able to come together to do that since 2022. Now, Lebanon's an interesting dynamic where they have so many different religious groups. Each different group gets a different slice on political office. Like the Shia, memory serves me right, the Shia Muslims get the prime ministership, the Sunni Muslims get Speaker of the House, Orthodox Christians get the deputy prime minister, and the presidency, which has a decent amount of power anyway, is supposed to go to the Maronite Church, which is an autonomous church within the Catholic Church. So a Catholic, by Lebanese law, has to fill this slot. This is what Paralin said about the presidency, quote, "The president alone is the head of state and a symbol of national unity. It is their role to uphold respect for the Constitution, the country's independence, and integrity of its territories." And he said later, "It's an urgent, absolute necessity to get this presidency in." So sounds a bit diplomatic, sounds a bit lofty, but at the same time, he's saying our guy basically is supposed to get this seat. Give our guy this seat. Also, within his visit, he had an interfaith meeting with all these different faith leaders, including the local Catholic Church, the Armenian Orthodox representatives, Sunni representatives, everybody important, it seems like, except for anybody to do with the Shia community, aka the community Hezbollah belongs to. He even invited a representative of Samir Jaja, who longtime listeners of the program may know is this Catholic warlord that used to do a lot of damage within Lebanon decades back. He invited him to this religious meeting. This would be the equivalent of the second most powerful man in the Catholic Church, which is what Parolin is, going to the United States, inviting all these different religious groups, inviting Donald Trump, not having anybody in the Democratic Party, and then talking to everybody how the political system is dysfunctional and there needs to be a solution. Even if he doesn't say the quiet part out loud, everybody knows what he's talking about. He's basically talking about putting in a government. This all remains to be seen. But it goes without saying the Catholic Church has a huge interest with what's going on in the Middle East, with what's going on in Lebanon's large Catholic population, with what's going on with the Gaza war. We talk on this program a lot about Europe getting involved in the Middle East. We go to prophecies like Daniel 11, Hosea 5, which talk about Israel inviting the Europeans in, the Germans in, to solve their problem. But it's not just European politicians or European armies that the Israelis are interested in. You can tie this in with other prophecies that we go to normally for Mr. Palmer's segment, like Revelation 17, which speak of a beast, a symbol of an empire, a symbol of this European empire to pop up. But most crucially, it's ridden by a woman, which if you cross-reference with other scriptures like Ephesians 5, 2 Corinthians 11, a woman in the Bible is a symbol of a church. And in this case, in Revelation 17, the woman guides the beast. The woman controls it like a horse. You move on to the next chapter. It talks about the kings of the earth doing business with this woman. This is a really powerful church. She has an interest in the Middle East, too. She has an interest with what's going on in Lebanon and Israel and all these places as well. And if our listeners would like to learn more, I could recommend our book by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Fleury, The Eternal Has Chosen Jerusalem, which talks about Jerusalem's history, Jerusalem's prophecy, why it's important, but specifically it also talks about why it's not just important, say, for the Jews or for true Christians today, but also why false Christianity is interested in this city, what the Church of Revelation 17 has in mind for this city and what it's going to do about it soon.
And of course, all of these scriptures do just tie perfectly together. And even Daniel 11, this passage that describes the clash in the Middle East, the king of the north led by Europe, fighting with the king of the south led by Iran. It talks about the king of the north going on and setting up its headquarters in the glorious holy mountain, as it puts it in Daniel 11 and verse 45, in Jerusalem. Why? From a political strategic point, yeah, it's a strategic location, but it doesn't seem compelling enough for Europe to move its headquarters to Jerusalem. The fact that it's putting it there, it shows that the Catholic Church is heavily involved in this European power's Middle East policy and other policies, tying it in directly with what we just heard from Mihailo there. I think it's just fascinating that Daniel 11 itself draws attention to really the role that this religious power plays in setting up this kind of alliance.
Our generation is not used to the Catholic Church guiding a superpower, but generations and generations and generations of human beings have been very used to that being the case. And if you're thinking, wait, geopolitics, you know, I'm tuning in for the news, maybe the geopolitics, I'm getting prophecy, I'm getting religion, we're talking about the glorious holy mountain. I thought that was religion. I thought that was separate. That's part of reality. The reality is that the Bible does describe news. It describes geopolitics. It assigns it to certain time periods. It even describes certain individuals. It definitely describes certain governments and empires. And it's on you to look at the Eternal Has Chosen Jerusalem and ask yourself, does this match up with what I see on the news? Is this just religious or is this reality? That's The Eternal Has Chosen Jerusalem there at thetrumpet.com. That's all the time we have for today. We appreciate you listening. We encourage you to email us your thoughts on the program, on past programs, on the current program, on future programs. We'll tell you more about that in future shows. Email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. We thank our panel, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, and Mihailo Zekic. And thanks to Parker Campbell and the ever faithful Isaac Lorenz. Even on the road, he gets these edited, so we appreciate all of his efforts for engineering and production. But the biggest thanks of all every week goes to you for listening to Trumpet Hour Week in Review. We'll be back with you next week.